You are listening to the Shopify Solutions Podcast, a podcast for Shopify store owners that brings you concrete examples on how to build and grow your e-commerce business. My name is Scott Austin, and I have an e-commerce agency named Jade Puma. In this podcast, I'll share my e-commerce insights and best practices with you. Hey, Scott Austin here. And for this episode, I'll be having another conversation with a Shopify store owner. I'll be talking with Todd Hamrick of PianoGiftIdeas.com. Todd and his business are in the very early days, so our conversation covers a lot of foundational principles of finding product market fit that many other new or aspiring store owners may benefit from. A couple of quick notes. I didn't start the conversation with the intention of it being a podcast. It was just a normal online consult. So you'll be dropped right into the conversation without a typical introduction. And once again, apologies for the audio quality, as it was less than ideal, and I'm still trying to figure out how to record two-person online audio. Okay, so here we go.
Why this, piano gift idea came up, and if you had, is it a passion project, or was there some unique differentiator behind it that you were thinking about from a business standpoint, or that kind of thing?
No, I mean, I just started with a piano theme because that's my background. So I spent 25 years in the music industry as a performer and recording engineer and on that side of things, and I'm transitioning away from that. And so a few years ago, I was kind of scrambling around trying to figure out what else can I possibly do. And I really like what I'm seeing on what e-commerce has to offer. So I ended up in this course, and they just kind of had a formula for how to pick, your niche, and that's kind of where I landed. I was thinking, well, I'll start with piano just because it's stuff that I can relate to people who are interested in piano stuff.
Yep.
I don't have a business background. It's been a pretty rough transition going from somebody who cared purely about the quality of art to caring about finance and, generating income. And so I've just been kind of scratching the surface and scrambling around for the last few years, trying to familiarize myself with how to build a business. And this was just kind of the first shot. So what you're seeing is, I was thinking that, okay, I'll start with piano. I don't think the name, having piano in the name, I created that before I knew anything about SEO. And I figured, well, if I just put piano gift ideas in the name, when somebody Googles piano, I need piano gift ideas, this will be the first thing that pops up. Now I know that's not necessarily the case, but
yes, it's a little more complex than that. Yeah, you understand now.
Yeah, but I was thinking that doesn't have to limit me from moving into other markets. Basically any sort of gift that's music themed, guitarists and bassists and horn players. And now I'm kind of thinking that, I'm looking at possibly doing affiliate links, because if I search for piano gift ideas, I see blog posts that are like 25 best gifts for piano players.
Yep.
And I'm thinking, okay, well, maybe that's an easier model to focus on first. It's just, I got my Amazon affiliate account set up, and so I'm kind of getting ready to start working on that angle. But I don't know the market size, and in fact, I figured you were going to start there, and I went and I tried to do some keyword stuff, and I realized I was using keywords everywhere, and since the last time I used it, it's a paid service now, so it was free. I don't know if you're familiar with that Chrome extension.
No. I just usually go into Google AdWords and use their keyword planning tool.
Ah, yeah, okay. So no, I don't know the big the market size is, and that's as soon as you came back and said, let's see if this makes sense, I figured that we would look at it, what the potential is, and I really don't know how to measure that.
We'll do that in this call. So that'll be the fun part. So, but before that, so there's the total number of people that you can get to, you know, let's say you're United States only. So there's 330 million people. And then, you know, your people that are piano, you know, aficionados, and we'll get to that number. We'll figure that out. And we'll just guess, right? And that's always good enough. So that's at the macro level. Let's look at it from the micro level for a second. So right now, your products are sourced from where?
So I've got a mixture. I started out, when I built the course, it was all AliExpress.
Okay.
And I want to get away from that, because I don't want to have, if I'm a customer, I don't want to see 4 to 6 weeks on delivery time.
Yep.
I know I could change that if I was actually purchasing inventory and storing
yep.
it, but
yep.
I'm not going to do that yet. So what I've started to do is create print-on-demand products. So that's a lot of what you're seeing on the front page of the site. Is print on demand with, I can't remember. I always get these confused, Printful or Printify.
Yep.
I don't know why.
In your Shopify store, you can have both of those installed if you wanted to. And I've done that for a lot of people where we do two or three print on demand providers because each one has different products and different things that their quality is better at and worse at, kind of thing. So you can have more than one in there if you want to. So let's talk about your, you know, whether it's AliExpress or print on demand, right? So you're buying a product, you're not holding inventory. So you're buying it when it's sold, right? And then,
right.
you know, you sell it for X dollars, you buy it from them for Y dollars, and that gives you Z profit. Right now, do you know what that profit margin is from a dollar standpoint or a percentage standpoint for your products? You know, let's just pull up, you know, I see you got a lot of mugs. If we were to use a mug as an example where you're selling this one here for $25, what does that cost you when someone buys it?
I'm following the formula. There were a couple of different formulas I was given
yep.
in the course of it taking. So the print on demand stuff, they said to price the items 2.5 times the cost plus whatever your shipping cost is.
Are you providing free shipping?
Yes.
Okay. So this product here, do you know what this one costs you? Just a round number, $10, $15, $20.
Let me switch back over here to you. So that's an AliExpress.
What do you think that cost you from AliExpress?
I don't remember. I'm going to guess 10, 12.
Okay.
Maybe.
Does that include shipping?
So when I calculate the price, it's, I'm adding in the shipping cost to that. Oh, so maybe, yeah. It was probably 12.
Okay.
So for the cost and the shipping.
So you're selling it for $39.95, which I'm just going to say is 40, and it costs you $12. So there's a profit in there of $28 when you sell one, right?
Right.
Now, how many of these do you think you have sold?
Zero.
Yep. And why do you think that is? Let me put it to you this way. Would you buy this mug for $40?
Probably not.
What would you buy this mug for?
I wouldn't buy this mug.
Okay. And I'm going to give you a real example. So my best friend bought me 10 years ago a mug with my name on it. Because in 2008, Starbucks did a series of mugs, right, for cities in America, and my name is Austin. It's actually a really big mug. I've used it for 10 years, every day, twice a day. It's not here right now because it's in the kitchen. And I dropped it the other day. Like, literally, just the other day, I dropped it. And there's a long crack down the side. It didn't break, so it's super strong. There's a long crack down the side. Now, the coffee has actually stained that crack in. And I want to replace this mug. And I just brought up, you know, and people were selling it used and all that kind of stuff. Here is $25. It's a gift from my best friend that I've used every day for 10 years. And I'm still like, I don't know if it's worth $25, right? Kind of thing, right? And that's just me.
Right.
And that's a test case to one. this mug here for $40, you know, I'm kind of frank about things. It seems ludicrous. This at $20 seems high to me, but you know, maybe the fact that it's got the little piano in the handles, you know, kind of cool, and there's an audience for it. So I could be totally wrong in that, but this price seems really, really, really high, right?
And I think part of what might be happening with that is that I had it set there, and then I had it priced at, there was like a 50% off sale.
Yep.
So it looked like there was a huge discount, and...
You don't have to defend it, right? Because I think the cause to this is you've been given some really bad freaking advice, right? Which is normal, right? There's, you know, the beautiful thing about Shopify or e-commerce in general as an ecosystem, right, is this concept that was started, you know, the 4-hour work week, right? We've all, you know, I never read the book, but I know all the concepts behind it. I understand it pretty well, right? But that book was also written, I think, in 2006 or 2008, when setting up an e-commerce website was really, really hard, right? And getting products shipped over from China was really, really, really hard. So in 2008, if you could source this mug and build a website around it, you could sell it really easily, relatively speaking, right? Nothing's easy. But today, in 2020, right, 12 or 14 years later, everything is so easy. The whole world is so interconnected that, you know, as you well know, you can get a Shopify website up and spinning in literally an hour's time, you know, a full day if you want to, you know, have a decent looking kind of thing. We're back when the 4-hour work week was written, you know, you had to buy your own servers or, you know, install, you know, software and get it up and running. It was really, really hard, right? So today, because it's so easy, you know, all these best practices that have been lying around for 12, 15 years of, hey, if you can do this and that, you know, you just make money by sitting back and resting on your laurels, right? So that part of it, it's so easy now, everybody can do it, right? So the business dynamics from back then are no longer true. And then the opposite side is also true in that everybody's on the internet. Everybody's, you know, connected on their phone all the time. So it's just like, if I can get my website up and running, I'm going to have a ton of users coming to me. That's no longer true, right? Because there's so many people supplying so many stores that the demand for customers' attention has also gone up so much higher that it's hard to get customers to your store. So back in 2008, this store would have had a much easier time being successful because there was less competition from a number of stores standpoint, and there was also less competition for customers' eyeballs or their wallet, right, kind of thing. So, you know, there's a lot of best practices out there that espouse a whole bunch of things that are based on things that are no longer true. So, you know, let's take this, you know, coffee mug as an example where someone told you, oh, you got to sell it for 2.5 times, you know, what you bought it for, right? And that's in the retail world, that kind of makes sense. But the problem is you're not paying wholesale price for this product, right? This product at a $12 fully burdened cost, you know, is relatively low if you're buying just one of them. It makes sense. But if you're a big, you know, if you're, you know, a store that's on Amazon selling this mug and you have an inventory of 10,000 of them in your, you know, warehouse, you paid way, way, way less than that, right? So that's why it's easy on Amazon or any other store to find products. It's amazing to me how cheap things are today, right? You buy things and it's like $10, $20. I mean, I bought a scale the other day that's like Bluetooth and talks to my phone. It was $22. I'm like, that blew my mind how cheap it was because, you know, things are so efficient in the world. But then you come out with a coffee mug and someone tells you, oh, 2.5 times what you bought it for, you know, which is, you know, 2.5 times of volume price makes sense. 2.5 times of print on demand price or AliExpress prices doesn't make as much sense. So then you mark it up by that factor because that's, you know, the metric somebody gave you. And now you have a coffee mug whose price is, like I said, ludicrous. I don't see this ever selling at $39.95. And then someone else gave you another best practice that said, well, then jack your prices up to 2x and then do everything 50% off, right? And that to me is even worse because it's so transparent. I saw that on one of your prices somewhere I was on, maybe it was on your mugs, right? Yeah, here we go. The Trump Piano Teacher mug. Regular price $50. Now it's only $25, right? That to me just screams, I'm here to rip you off. Yeah. And forget the customer perception side of it, right? But even at $25, you know, that seems kind of expensive to me. Now, from your cost standpoint, it's a reasonable price to charge, which is one side, right? One side is what you price it at based on your cost and the profit margin you're going after. The other side you need to price it at is what are consumers willing to pay for it? And those two sometimes don't meet, right? And that's probably the situation you're in right now, where to be a profitable business, your pricing is a prohibition of people buying, right?
Yeah.
It's preventing people.
I hear you loud and clear. And I think one of the things that I was confused about on pricing, and I think this sort of clicked for me recently, is that the 2.5 times is supposed to have the sale built in underneath that. So the $24.95 is supposed to be the 2.5 times, and then I'm supposed to put it on sale from there and still be able to profit.
Agreed, but I'm going to take a step back and say you're playing with an equation, which I'm just going to say is false. The way you need to price products is what is competitive in your marketplace. And, you know, I've talked to people who price it up because their quality is higher and it's a unique product, and that all makes sense, right? On a product that you're making yourself, your profit margin is going to end up being much higher. What I was talking about was, you know, on the pricing side of things, where if you price it just based on your metrics, right, 2.5 times my cost, you're not thinking about the other half of the equation, which is what is the competitive set, you know, going to allow you to charge for this kind of thing. You know, there are times where you charge 100 times your cost because you've got a unique product and there's high demand, right? And there's other times where you don't charge, you know, twice as much, or, you know, you don't mark it up 50% because it's competitive and your costs are high for whatever reason, but the market won't bear that markup. So just blindly saying the rule is 2.5 times for markup just ignores one half of the equation, right? And and in that, your costs are just higher than your competition by the nature of you doing print on demand and AliExpress, you know, stuff, buying them one at a time. Some print on demand stores that I've seen before, I think print on demand is a really tough business, right? Especially if that's your whole business or most of your business, because the print on demand guys, you know, for a t-shirt or whatever, and I'm just going to use a general number, it may not be 100% accurate, but for a t-shirt printed, you know, including shipping, they're going to charge you $17 or whatever. And it's really hard to charge more than $25 for a t-shirt. And that 2.5 thing said it should be $40, right? If you charge $25, a reasonable number for that t-shirt, your margin is only $8, which we haven't even talked about the customer acquisition side of the cost of things, right? You know, customer acquisition cost is, and we'll get into that in a second here, is a really big expense, a massive expense, right? You know, businesses that are doing large volumes that are doing advertising as a revenue stream, which all big businesses are. Nobody's purely organic, with the exception of maybe Tesla or something, right? But all the e-commerce stores out there, they're doing ads, and you know the cost per customer is really high. So the point I'm making is a couplefold. One is when you think about pricing, you need to think about the customer in that equation and what is a reasonable price for this product. And the other side of it is, you need to have products that allow you to price it reasonably and still give you enough margin to, at the end of the day, have a profit. Quite frankly, where you're at right now, with the markets coming from AliExpress and print on demand, it doesn't leave you a lot of margin. Are you selling t-shirts in your store?
Yeah, I have a few.
A piano t-shirt, right? Would you pay $30 for that?
I don't know.
It's close. Right? That's a tough one.
Yeah.
I could see that t-shirt at Target for, you know, literally, you know, $8.95, right, kind of thing.
Yeah, for sure.
And the quality of your T-shirts are from the print-on-demand company, so the quality is not that high. I've seen, you know, T-shirt businesses that are really successful, and they bring their T-shirt production in-house because the quality of the print-on-demand guys isn't good enough for them long-term. Because in the reality of this is, you know, the hardest part of an e-commerce store is customer acquisition, in my mind. Building the store is the easiest part. Coming up with products is hard. Fulfilling it is hard, but you're trying to automate that process, which is what's eating away at your margin, right? Because you're automating that and giving someone else that money. And therefore, the customer acquisition side is the hardest part, right? A lot of new store owners, and I'm not saying this is yours, but a lot of new store owners are like, well, I'm just going to build a store. And, you know, because I'm popular on Facebook or Instagram, or because I got a good, you know, keyword strategy, I'm going to become competitive in SEO and social and free social and get a lot of traffic that way, right? The reality is, for a new store, that is really, 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 really hard, right? You know, I have one client we just did an SEO investigation on and found that, you know, they have better content than their competition from an SEO standpoint. Their store gets indexed better. We've done all the technical things right. But of them and their 20 competitive stores, because they're in niche space also, right? And there's like 20 other stores on the internet that are competing against them. And we think they have the best quality of content, maybe the second or third best kind of thing. But they're only getting to the second page in Google and not onto the first page. And the reason for that is they have the least number of inbound links of all their competition by an order of magnitude, right? Most of the other stores have an average of 1,000 inbound links and they've got 100. So,
okay. So wait, what's an inbound link?
Someone else on the internet linking to your store, right?
Okay.
So yeah. The number one thing that is going to get you to the Google's top search result is people linking to your store. And if no one is linking to your store, no matter what you do on your site, unless it's the most fringe thing in the planet, you're not going to rank on the first page for it, right? So for these guys, what we did for an SEO strategy next step is, all right, we need to build a link building strategy. And that just says we're going to figure out how, and there's a thousand different ways to do this, to get people to link to our website. So SEO is A, a long-term game, and B, you need inbound links to be successful at it. A lot of people try to be successful at SEO with just what they do on their site. You got to do all that. That's like table stakes. Doing all the right on-site optimizations, you must do. But then to actually be successful, you need to have a link building strategy where people are linking to you, right? And that can be a whole number of different things. So the point being, for customer acquisition, you need to think about paid customer acquisition for a new store. Because you're not going to be competitive in SEO, even though you should be invested in that over the long term. Absolutely. Because it'll pay off down the road. But in a new store in the beginning, it's going to be paid advertisement. Or, you know, if you are, you know, Justin Timberlake or something, maybe you have enough of a social following to do it, right? I've met store owners who tried to build their store and their business around their, you know, 10, 50,000, I think 50,000 was their number of Instagram followers, which is a great number, right? Fabulous number, but you can't build a business behind it, right? You just do the math of 50,000 Instagram followers, and I'm just going to, off the top of my head, make broad generalizations. Of 50,000 Instagram followers, let's say half of them are real, right? Because the other half are probably fake. Half of them are fake. We now have 25,000. And let's say we can get 8% of those people to come to our website. And I just pulled that number out of the air. Right? Let's say we can get 8% of those people to come to our website, right? So 0.08, that's 2,000 people to our website. Okay, we got 2,000 people. Now let's say we have an average site conversion rate of 3%. So let's multiply that times 3%. Now we have 60 sales. So my 50,000 user following on Instagram yields me 60 sales. Now, what's the frequency I can get that number of sales out of those people? Once a year?
Right.
It's not once a day, it's not once a month, right? Maybe once a year, twice a year. So your 50,000 Instagram followers gets you 60 sales a year or 120 sales a year, whatever number. Point being, that doesn't build you a business, right?
Right.
So you're gonna have to be paying for your customers. On Facebook, you know how, I think you said you were testing some Facebook ads, right?
Right, yeah.
And what do you think the, how much dollars did you spend to make one sale? Do you know that number?
So what I have is like a 4-day,
yep,
$5 a day cycle,
yep,
for each product. And if it's not profitable, then cut it, move on to the next product. And, you know, you're basically looking for something that really the people respond to. To get that, the one sale, I mean, it was within one of those. Actually, with that one, it was the neck warmer thing. At the time, I was calling it a neck gaiter.
So is that a COVID mask?
What's that?
Is that a COVID mask?
That was the idea.
So you've had one product that sold, right? And it cost you...
One, I actually, with that one, I didn't do one ad. I tested. I ran three ads.
Okay.
Three, you know, so I could test. I created a little video, and then I compared two different images. And one of those led to a sale. So it was part of a $20 cycle.
So that cost you $20 for a customer. Let's just say that, right?
Right, yeah.
Which is actually, and that's one of your products, and all the other tests you did didn't work out yet, right? So let's just assume for a second that you could sell more of those at $20 per customer. Is that profitable for you? So if I look at your net gaiter, let's see what your price is. It's $44.
Yeah, I probably sold it at, not at 44, but at 22.
So it cost you $20 to sell something for $22. So yeah. Your total cost for that sale, let's just assume this net gaiter printed on demand cost you 12 bucks with shipping.
Yeah.
Okay. So
yeah, yeah.
12 plus 20 for the cost of acquisition, that's $32.
Right.
And you sold it for 22. So you lost $10 on that sale, which that's not a problem, right? Because, you know, when you begin, you're going to lose money and you're learning, right? You're testing and learning. But the uber point to make from that is $20 for a cost of acquisition on Facebook is actually kind of low. And it's going to depend on a whole bunch of dynamics, right? Everything always depends on your situation. But, you know, $25 is like an average cost of acquisition for a customer on Facebook. So, like, I've had customers who sell a product for 20 bucks. And they have huge profit margin. Like, they make it in China and delivered to them in the United States, it costs them a dollar, right? And it's actually, you know, a pretty cool product. So it's reasonable to sell it at $20. So it gives them $19 in margin and a huge percentage-wise margin. But it's still not enough to buy Facebook ads, because Facebook's too expensive, right? So they have to go to other ad sources, whether it's Pinterest or Instagram or Google or whatever else kind of thing, or influencers and that kind of thing. Because Facebook today is really, 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 really competitive from an advertising cost standpoint. Where Facebook in 2012, when a lot of these best practices were started, was really competitive because nobody was advertising on Facebook yet. But now everybody in the world advertises on Facebook first and Google second. Where it used to be Google first, nobody second in the past, right? So now, and the beauty of Facebook versus Google, right? So Google search is going to get you what I call the intended shopper, right? Someone's in a shopping mode and they actually search for piano gift ideas, right? And so the intention's already there and the keywords that you're targeting. In Facebook, what you're doing is you're going after the unintended shopper. So they're on Facebook looking at baby pictures or cat memes or whatever they're doing. And all of a sudden an ad pops up that says, hey, you know, because you targeted, you know, people that like piano or whatever you're doing for targeting. Hey, how about this cool piano gift idea, right? And they're like, oh, that's interesting. They had no intention of shopping today, but you attracted them, right? So that's the beauty of Facebook, is you can go out and proactively pull your customers in to a shopping experience. But that also means it's really, really competitive because everybody wants to do that. So Facebook becomes really expensive, and... you know, because the system has got a lot of power to it, it's easier to start on that platform, but it's also way, way more expensive to start on that platform. Where, you know, one thing to look, you know, so the point being, you know, you're going to have to pay for customers, and that's going to cost you a lot of dollars, right? And then add to that, you're in a low margin, well, you're priced too high based on this 2.5 rule because your cost, your COGS are high, right? So just because your COGS are high doesn't mean you can charge a higher price. So that means, you know, your prices have to come down to be a more competitive price. Sample size of one, my NetGator that I bought on Amazon, I bought that on Amazon for $8.95, right? And it was in my house the next day. So this for, you know, $44.95, you've really got to get someone who loves that design. And, you know, your designs aren't that differentiated, or I don't think they're worth that much of an increase. And maybe they are. I could be totally wrong in that. But you've got this, your price too high, your costs are high because of the business model you're in, and customer acquisition can only done through paid channels, then that always costs a lot of money, and it only gets higher for that, you know, every year, right? Because more and more ad dollars go online, we'll get more successful at it. So all of that leads up to, you know, it's, you know, you're in a tough space, right? And you listen to these people who are either full of crap, to be perfectly frank, or base their learnings and what they're sharing with you on business dynamics and internet dynamics that no longer exist. So because everybody buys internet ads today, and anybody can build a website, and it's so easy to source stuff reasonably cheaply, you know, I could build your store and be in competition with you by the end of the day, right?
Yeah.
You know, this is so easy to do that what you have to do is distinguish yourself. And a lot of my clients distinguish themselves with their products, and they make their own products. There's something unique about their products. A, I love the fact you picked a niche, right? You picked a niche. So that to me is a good thing. Early on in my Shopify days, I had this client come to me, and it was my most expensive project at the time, because they wanted me to incorporate all these data feeds for all these sporting good products. And I'm like, don't you want to just focus on something like, you know, hiking or hunting or whatever? Like, no, I want everything. So I was like, I don't advise this, but I built it for him, right? And he had like 45,000 products in his store and all sorts of navigation and taxonomy, all the stuff going on. And then he realized, just because he had the store with 45,000 products in it, doesn't mean he's going to sell a single one. And customer acquisition is the hardest thing, and he had no margin to do that with, kind of thing. He literally shut his store down before we launched it, because he realized that being broad and generalist is actually a negative for small stores, right? Being focused is a good thing. So, you know, the decision you made that I like is, I'm going to focus on this audience that I know and can build rapport with, right?
Yeah.
Now, that said, you know, some of the things that, if you're going to do that, you know, what about, and I'm going to start with the products, right? What about your products are great? Because good isn't good enough today, right? On the internet, you know, good products, you know, you're going to find mediocre and good products on Amazon. Why are people going to leave Amazon and come to you from a product standpoint? And you don't have to answer that question, right? Because it's a hard question to answer.
Right.
A lot of my clients do it by, you know, a couple different ways, right? One way is they have their own products, and so their products are unique, right? You can't get them elsewhere. There may be competitions. Like, I have a lot of clients whose products are patented, and they defend their patents, as you should if you have a patent, kind of thing. So they are the only place you can get it, kind of thing. So other clients, you know, make their site a better shopping experience by having more information about them. Like, I have a lot of people who resell, you know, commercial or industrial types of products. I have one that does water fountains, for example. But on their water fountain site, they're doing a better job educating you. Now, you know, this isn't for consumers, obviously. Consumers don't buy water fountains. It's for, you know, park and recs and gyms and that kind of stuff. But they do a really great job in educating the customer about different types of water fountains and the pros and cons. You need this one for this situation and that one for... So their value add is consultation, right? And you also get on the phone with them and talk them through things and all that kind of stuff. So your store has to be unique and differentiated somehow, by products, by price. And don't ever compete on price, because you'll never win against the big players. Or by quality or authenticity. You know, there's a lot of stores that are built based on a personality of a person.
Yeah.
You know, Kylie Jenner or something like that. Or people become celebrities in their own little space and build on that over time also. So it's really hard to say, I'm going to focus on this thing. Just gather the pieces that are around that are easy to do and build a store. Right. You saw how easy it was to build a store. And I'm not saying it was super, super easy, right? I'm sure there's a ton of, you know, frustration and figuring things out. But in general, you know, you couldn't have done this 10 years ago. It would have been impossible, right? Even 5 years ago would have been hard. But today, not too hard, you know, relatively speaking.
Yeah, exactly.
What about your store is going to be something that is going to engage people or be unique, right? What's unique in your store? And right now, I'm not seeing it, right? And I built many a print-on-demand store, and very, very, very few of them are still around because they are so easy. And I've even done ones that are very focused with all unique designs. The customer, I had one customer, and he was like it was a sports thing. He was actually really good. It's a small, you know, insular sporting community, and he competed at the national and world level at that. And he thought if he could just build something, because he was so well known in that space, it would just sell. And it's like, no, it's a full-time job selling, right? Just because you build a great site and have great content, you know, any one of my clients who's successful is constantly working to bring sales in. You just can't set up a bunch of ads and put it on autopilot and it just runs on its own. You're always doing something from a marketing and sales standpoint to attract people to the site. New copy, new creative, new channels, new PR, talking to people, you know, reaching out, all that good stuff. You know, I have one client who literally spends, you know, 2 or 3 hours a week and has been doing this for like 8 years now, reaching out to influencers. And every week he sits down and does it, and he has a whole process he goes through, always looking for new influencers, but he never skips a week. And he's super successful because he never skips a week, right? He's always doing that work. The Uber point being the 4-hour work week concept, really hard to do with a new store like this, right? It's a full-time job. Even if you already have a full-time job, this is another full-time job, kind of thing, as I'm sure you're realizing already. So,
well, is this, I mean, overall, do you think, I mean, how do we decide or what's your opinion on if this is a worthwhile endeavor, you know, this niche, and can I take kind of the concept that you're seeing and start doing some things right and have it be something worth pursuing?
So let's look at it from the other end. That's a great question, right? So, because, you know, the reality is there are some niches that are just too small, right? Like, I used to play roller derby. I coach roller derby for kids now. And the roller derby world is bigger now than when I started doing it like 10 years ago. But back then, there were like 4,000 people playing roller derby in America. Just too small, right? Even if you sold to every one of them, there's not enough money in it, kind of thing. So some niches are too small. So let's actually look at this. How many pianos in the United States? At least 20% have pianos in their home today of households, right? There's 100 million households, and we could estimate that 20%. And look at this. You know, I just searched for how many pianos in the United States on Google, and I'm not even on a website, right? The first three lines are the answer, right? So the research, you know, who knows how accurate these numbers are, but I'm going to guess they're close enough, right? It gives me what I need to know, right? So assuming there have been at one time 28 million pianos in the U.S., there are 100 million households. We could estimate that at least 20% have pianos in their homes. Another stat down here I'm looking at says 31,000 pianos were sold in the United States in a year. This, you know, 31,000 pianos is not a lot, but, you know, 20 million homes is a lot. And, you know, every piano in a house, there's more than one person. There may be more than one person that plays it. Pianos, you know, people have digital, you know, synthesizers or play piano on their iPhone kind of stuff. But this says, you know, there's a market, right? As opposed to if we did this and it said, well, you know, there's 5,000 people that play piano. There's probably more than, I think the 20 million number's high, to be honest with you, right? Even if there's 20 million pianos in homes today, like I have a friend who has a piano in their house and it's beautiful and it's literally decoration. We can always argue one or two, you know, we can always prove our point within a sample set of one. And I just like to look at things in really broad numbers. But let's just say there's, you know, it says 20 million homes today have a piano. Let's say half of them are in use. There's 10 million people. So somehow you have to find a way to target 10 million people. 10 million people is enough to build a business off of. So I'm just saying off the top of my head, there's 10 million piano players in the United States. That number may be higher. It may be lower. But you could build off of that. But to do that, how much is it going to cost you to find those people, and can you target them? And that's the kind of stuff that, you know, with your Facebook testing, you know, I don't know what sort of targeting you're doing, but is, you know, plays piano, is that an easy thing to find through the ad targeting systems that exist today?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So, you know, the audience that I'm aiming at or supposed to aim at from my, you know, instructions is between 100,000 and 500,000. So,
okay.
That they're saying that should be scalable somewhere in that number. So, yeah, it's pretty easy for me to, there's something like, maybe 13 million in the piano interest category, but that's pretty broad. I'm going super specific, people who obviously have a deep passion for it. So I'm going with people who teach piano or study piano. And then sometimes I also cross it with, like, if I'm selling a mug, I'll cross that with coffee enthusiasts. It'll be piano people who love coffee should be able to sell them a mug.
So what I'm looking at right now is a study of piano declining in the United States of America. Now, I like to do a bunch of internet searches and just read as much as I can. Just to understand. But also, as you start reading this, you may start figuring out things you can focus on. You said one already, right? Piano teachers, piano lessons.
Yeah.
So maybe, you know, you figure out a way to target people that are teachers or lessons and that kind of thing, and figure out, you know, not only what your broad niche is of piano, you know, people with a piano affinity, but how are you going to find them and what is the purpose? Is this actually a piano gift, or is this I'm a piano person and I buy this for myself, right? Because a lot of times, you know, there are certain products that are great as gifts, and there are certain products that are purchased by the person themselves because some of the decision-making criteria is really, really hard, right? And, you know, my poor mom, you know, I got in my head when I was a kid, there were certain things my mom liked. Like, she liked brass and cardinals. So every gift I gave her was either brass or a cardinal. And I'm sure, you know, by the time I was 12, she's just rolling her eyes the whole time. Oh, God, another cardinal or another brass thing, that kind of thing. But, you know, that said, you'll figure those kind of things out. The question becomes, you know, step one, and you'll learn this over time, do people buy this for themselves or are they buying it as a gift? And the gift idea actually is a pretty good one, right? If you know someone that plays piano, gift giving is really hard. And to have something that's particular to them is pretty good. Now, you know, if you're a piano teacher, everybody just may give you piano gifts all the time and you're just annoyed by it. But, you know, in general, it's not a bad idea to start with that this is going to be a gift giver. Hey, you know, give this to your piano teacher, or give it to your mom who likes piano, or give it to your student who's studying piano, your child, whatever. No, that's an assumption you're making, right? So one of the things you need to figure out is, do people actually buy piano-themed gifts for other people? Or when people buy piano-themed things, are they buying it for themselves? I don't know of a way to know that today other than starting to talk to people, right? You know, you've done a sale. Have you called that person and said, hey, did you buy this for yourself? Or did you buy it for someone else, right? Kind of thing. And
yeah. And
literally, when you're first starting out, calling your customers and asking them questions like that makes total sense. It is a total non-scalable thing, right? When you're selling 10 million items a year, you would never, ever do. But every single person who, who makes a sale with you, call them up. If you've got a phone number, give them a call. And, you know, if you're inhibited by that and shy by that, which I personally would be, get over it. Figure it out, right? Right?
Yeah.
Well, when I first started doing things like that, oh, God, I would force myself, like, I'm going to call 10 potential customers today, right? And I would not allow myself to get out of my chair until those 10 were done. And it was physically painful for me to do that. But you have to do that kind of research to start knowing the answers to the questions. Because right now, everything's an assumption. What we need to do is turn our assumptions into facts or things that we know, right? Validating our assumptions is the term they use a lot of times. You need to validate those assumptions and understand your customer. When I talk to a store owner that's really successful, or even, you know, large businesses, it's amazing to me how much they know about their customer and their customer's thought process and the value prop that their product or service provides to those customers. That level of understanding is going to make you successful. It's hard. Like, all this stuff is hard, you know. People told you e-commerce is going to be easy. We're lying to you. Or basing their evaluation on a world that no longer exists, because e-commerce today is hard. It's easy, technically. It's, you know, easy to have a store and all that kind of stuff and source products. It's hard to turn that into a profitable revenue stream.
Yeah.
You know, the question you were asking is, you know, is this the, have you made some of the right decisions? Picking a niche, I think, is a great decision. Going with print on demand and AliExpress, not a fan of that for the reasons we talk about, and that's basically a margin thing and a differentiation thing. But that said, you know, what are your options?
Yeah.
If you were to, you know, because what you're trying to do here is have a broad list of products that appeal to customers, you know, because maybe the NetGator doesn't apply to everybody, right? And there are certain companies, and all they do is the latest fad of the season, and they do one product at a time, do it really well. That's really, really hard to do also. So there's all these things against, you know, this being successful. So the way it's going to be successful is if you're really good at figuring these things out and making some decisions and understanding things. You know, the business owners that I work with that are really, really good understand their business really well, their business, their customers, their products, all that kind of stuff, and are able to make decisions based on their business versus just, you know, like you took a course, they give you some equations. There's nothing wrong with that. That's a great starting point. But the next thing should be, all right, that's my base point. What have I learned from that? And how am I going to use that knowledge to make my next set of decisions that are no longer based on that incoming assumptions that my course gave me? Because the course is generic for everybody in every situation, and successful people are going to be very specific to their customers and their business.
Gotcha.
So yeah. I think it'd be really hard to be successful with a store like this, but to be successful in this, you're going to have some unique value prop, whether that's product or something else, and product in a store is the place to start with. If you're going to be successful in this space of piano-themed products for people that are either buying for piano fans or for piano fans to buy for themselves, then a site of products that are obviously print-on-demand and random things pulled off of container ships coming from China probably is not going to be a successful route, right? You might start out with that to have some conversations with people and talk to them. If you could, you know, sell 10 of your products and talk to 10 people on the phone, then the next, you know, one of the questions I'd ask them is, you know, are you buying this for you or for someone else as a gift? Next question I'd be is, what do you want? What is the product that you're missing today that would be really useful for you that you're looking for? And then figure out, well, this is what people want. How do I get that? You know, the short summary is a business where you're just going to buy things that are too expensive because it's quantity of one on time of purchase. It's going to be really, 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 really hard. When I say really four or five times, I mean impossible to build a profitable business doing that.
Yeah.
Because your margins are too small. Your cost of acquisition, your advertising cost is going to be so high because it's not differentiated. If your product is more differentiated, it's easier for you to figure out or to find people that it resonates with because there's no competition. Like, I don't have my wallet with me, but my wallet is made by this company here. And I absolutely love my wallet. I bought it during their first Kickstarter. Which was, I don't know, 2014 now, a long, long time ago, and it's still my wallet every day. But it's the only wallet like this, right? There's a lot of minimalist wallets out there. It's actually this, you know, piece of metal that's milled down to be a U, and your credit cards slide in and they literally click, right? There's a natural springiness to this, and I just love the technology and engineering behind this, right? But
how have I never seen that?
It's fabulous. It is fabulous. I love my wallet, right? Kind of thing. But the point being here is they're the only ones that make it. He's got a patent on it. He's got a good story behind it. You know, he built it when he was in Stanford grad school and that kind of stuff, did a Kickstarter. So this is a unique wallet. And if you love it, there's only one place you're going to get it from, and that's him. Now, there are other competition, you know, competitive wallets, but none exactly like this. It's unique, right? So it's point being, if your product's that unique and you put it in front of people, they either like it or they don't. They're like, a metal wallet? I don't want that. That's, you know, no. Other people like me were like, a metal wallet? Tell me more, right? Kind of thing. The more unique right. your product is, the easier it is to get a response. Whether that response is yes or no, you're getting a response. And understanding, does it work or does it not? So
yeah.
for you, well, let me turn this around to you. What do you think about everything I've said so far? What is your conclusion or just, you know, thoughts of, does this make sense?
I don't know. I feel pretty optimistic about it.
Okay.
But not, I mean, I don't hear that tone from you in it, but I also know that I haven't really done a great job of communicating everything. I haven't been executing what I'm supposed to very well, nor have I really communicated some of the strategies that are supposed to happen. You know, I mean, I'm supposed to be drawing people in with products that are under $10. So you're sourcing them for like $3, and then there's an upsell, and then...
Oh, no. Someone told you that garbage, and another complete lie they told you, right? Here's the truth, right? In your store in the beginning, expect an average customer lifetime value of one order.
Of what?
One order.
Okay.
So there's this whole concept of, yeah, you're going to acquire this customer and you're going to monetize them over a lifetime of, you know, 15 years kind of thing, which is great. And you should be shooting for that. Don't get me wrong, right? And like I have, you know, clients who sell coffee. I have multiple of them. And their whole thing is, you know, buy our coffee, get a subscription, and, you know, get that customer lifetime value going. But here's the thing. If you're doing piano gifts right now and I buy a piano gift for my piano friend for Christmas, am I going to buy them another piano gift? And if so, when? Right, the likelihood of me buying multiple times from you is fairly small. So, and this goes back to you need to take the best practices people are telling you and apply it to your business. Now, if I'm a piano fan, how many piano-themed products do I want in my life? Do I want to be that person who wears a piano scarf every day to work? For a next step, who's your target audience? Give me a persona, a type of person who's your audience.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's something I don't know. I was...
Sure you do. Make some guesses.
Okay. Some guesses. Probably, I mean, I'm thinking that it's probably going to end up leaning more towards women. So a female piano teacher or a mom purchasing a gift for a kid or...
So
my process was backwards, where I was thinking, well, I will target the audience, I will see who it attracts, and then that will tell me who the demographic is, you know?
Yeah, but, and what you're realizing, right, is when you take spaghetti and throw it against the wall and see what sticks, the amazing thing is nothing sticks. Nothing, right?
Yeah.
So you're right. You need to reverse that. So let's just take your two personas you just came up with. One was piano teacher, and the other was a parent who's trying to keep their kid excited about the parent-forced passion around piano, which, you know, I said that a little sarcastically, but I probably also mean that a little literally, right? I doubt the kid is that into piano, and it's probably the parent that's that into piano and wants their kid to be into piano. And if I'm wrong, I'm wrong, right? Kind of thing. So let's take those two. One is a gift or a bribe. And the other is I'm purchasing it for myself because it's the passion about my life. Go find. So where do you live?
In Ohio, Columbus.
So you live, I think, in the third most populated state in America, or the fourth or fifth. You know, Ohio is not a small state in population. So there's people around you, is my point. You can find people that are that persona. Find five piano teachers and five piano moms and ask them, what do they want?
Mm.
Now, how do you find them? Are there...
Plugged in to the piano community here.
There you go.
Pretty tightly. I mean, I taught for 10 years.
Yep.
Yeah.
Okay. So you know these people. Ask them the question.
Right.
So I used to make products. I used to make furniture and stuff like that. That's how I got into Shopify. I was selling my own stuff. And now I no longer do that at all. But I would like make certain things on the laser cutter and, you know, make full products out of them. And I would literally carry them with me. And I would be hanging out with my friends and I would put it down on the table and say, and just put a product on the table and let them play with it and let them interact with it and just listen. And then I'd start asking directed questions. Well, what do you like about this? What do you not like about this? What color would you want this in? What size would you want this in? Always asking questions and getting feedback.
Yeah.
So, you know,
that's definitely a missing piece in my life. I mean, part of going towards e-commerce and actually part of getting out of teaching was like some social anxiety stuff. But you're right. You're not wrong.
Well, I've gone to certain, you know, little startup weekends kind of stuff years ago now. And the first thing they said is, all right, get out of your chair and go outside and start asking questions to people. Come up with an assumption, start going asking questions to the first person you see. And the whole point of that was to get you over that. And believe me, I love working alone and not having to interact with people, right? I have that same, I don't want to talk to people. I don't want to bother them. I don't want to inconvenience them. It sickens me when I have to do those things. But you have to do those things. And then, you know, what you start realizing is the other side of it, if I'm a piano teacher and somebody asks me, what kind of piano products do you want in your life? Or, you know, what do you think of this, you know, necklace that I just designed, you know, with the little keys on it kind of thing? They want to give you their feedback. You wanted to talk to me, right? I do my podcast and you reached out and like, I want to talk to this guy, right? People want to give their opinions. So even though you may have that social anxiety about, you know, inconveniencing, the way I always think about it is I don't want to inconvenience people, right? But in the end, if you're talking to the right person about the right topic, all they want to do is talk to you about it.
Yeah.
And when they don't, then you move on kind of thing. But people want their voice heard. People want to express their opinions. So it's not like you're, you know, I have this guy in my neighborhood. He sells meat out of his truck for whatever reason. And he used to knock on my door and like trying to sell me meat at the end of the day. He's like, I still got meat left in my truck. You want to buy some? Kind of thing. Or the, you know, whatever other people knocking on my door. That's an inconvenience. Because they don't know a thing about me and they're not targeting me. But if you target people, you know, if you're trying to help a mom figure out a way to keep their kid playing piano, oh, they will love you, right? You're not an inconvenience at all.
That's a cool angle. And I hadn't thought about it that way because my experience was with music and with piano was my choice, and I was never forced to do anything, and therefore the love of it is still intact.
Yes, yes.
That's interesting, though. That's an interesting angle to think about the parent that's trying to keep the interest there. But, you know, I think what I'm feeling, what I'm seeing, and it could be misguided or stubborn, but I feel like there's so much good information, especially just from your podcast, that I could be putting into practice. It still makes me want to put that into practice on this site. Like, for example, when you were talking about having basically filter options so that you can help the customer make decisions, guide them to exactly what they're looking for. And I realized, whoa, if I'm trying to do this site that has all these gifts available, you know, I need to have filters by price available and all kinds of put everything in their face that I can possibly think of that they might be looking for filter wise. And that was a big aha moment for me. But, you know, I mean, if it's not, how do I determine if I shouldn't even be wasting time on it? Should I wipe the slate clean and start with something else, or I don't know?
I think it goes back to customer research. So I think it goes back to, you know, finding five teachers and five moms, talking to them. Because what's going to happen when that conversation is a couple of things. In one thing you're going to be doing is you're going to be understanding what products they're interested in. And another is you're going to understand what their motivations behind those products are, right? I'm kind of sarcastically saying moms bribing their kids. That may or may not be true, right? Maybe all the kids do have passion and don't need that kind of thing. And another thing you're going to be learning is the language they use to describe those things. Is this about showing your piano pride? Is it about celebrating the milestone of achievement? You know, all those kind of things. So what you're doing when you're talking to your customers, you're realizing what products they want, and you're also realizing what way to message those products to them, right? Like, you know, I'm going to use karate as an example. If you're a mom and your kid's in karate and they get their brown belt or whatever, right? That's a milestone, and you want to give them their brown belt. You know, so if I was a karate gift store, I'd start coming up with what's the appropriate gift for every color belt that your kid achieves, kind of thing. And, you know, here's this cool squirt gun to give them when they get their brown belt or whatever kind of thing. And that's a complete, you know, random example, but just to give you, you know, to think about why are they buying these things, what's the purpose behind it, and how do they word it so that you're talking. So when you go out with your Facebook ads or your Google ads or whatever ads you're going to do, you start using the language that resonates with them. And this is all stuff you need to do before you even get to the website. You need to have a website kind of thing, but you've got to attract them with the right message and the right product. It's not just the right product, it's the right message also. So in your conversations, those are the things you're learning. I hear you saying, like, what can I do on the site? I wouldn't start with that today. I'd start with the talk to the customers first. Five teachers, five moms. If not five, 10 of each, right? The more you talk to, the better. But just pick those two audiences. Don't go out to, you know, Billy Joel and that kind of stuff, right? Just stick with those two for right now. And talk to 5 to 10 of them each. And then ask your, you know, and have like three questions in your mind that you want to get answered. One question is, what sort of products do they want? Is it a gift or for themselves, which you kind of know with those two audiences already? And, you know, why would they buy them? Is this for Christmas or is it for their recital? For the mom, maybe they want to get a, hey, you did a great recital kind of thing. Here's a gift to commemorate that event. Or it might be, you know, hey, Johnny, if you do lessons for another year, I'll give you this thing here. So you want to start, you know, figuring out those things and the words that they use to describe that.
Yeah.
And they're going to be different, right? A mom's motivation is going to be completely different than the piano teacher's motivation. And there's nothing wrong with that, right? Because they're different scenarios. But with those two scenarios, now you've got two options, A or B. And in those conversations, what you want to figure out is which one of those two is lower hanging fruit for you. And then come up with a product and a message that resonates and then test that out.
Yeah, that's great. I like that. That's cool. I've never thought of it that way. That's really streamlined. Yeah.
I did a recent podcast and the basic wording of it was let your customer design your website. And all I'm saying here is let your customer design your business. What products are you going to go after? How are you going to message them? Let them tell you that. Remember, I was talking about the really successful businesses. It's amazing how well they understand their customer because they do all the stuff that we're talking about.
Awesome.
Does that give you an actionable next step? Now, if you were to set a deadline behind that, what would it be?
Oh, that's a good question. It's totally actionable and it's uncomfortable, but that's a good thing.
That is a very good thing.
Let's see. Deadline. I mean, what should it be? What would you what would you expect?
Let's do this. Let's say, you know, because next week's Christmas, and you know everybody's preoccupied. First week of the year, January 4th or whatever, you talk to three people per week for the month of January.
Oh, okay. That's great.
What we're doing there, instead of saying, you know, you have to talk to 10 people total by the end of January, which means on January 29th, you'll talk to nobody. We're going to make you do it every week with fewer people so that you're getting towards that goal.
That's great. That's good. I like that angle.
And then the goal of that is to make a decision on which one of those two personas is the first one to target and what sort of product to target them with and what sort of message.
Make a decision on which persona to target and then what was that after that?
And what's the message?
Like
get the best gift for your child's recital or reward yourself for a piano teaching season kind of thing.
Great. That's awesome.
And then, you know, once you make those decisions, then you can figure things out. And I'm a big fan, by the way, of that's the next milestone. Don't think beyond that. Right? Don't start predicting the future and trying to figure out, you know, what things are going to be in February. Because come January 30th, we'll be a whole lot smarter and can figure out what February should look like. So just take this next step and be open-minded. And at the end, you know, look at the data, look at the information, and then go, all right, here's what I've learned. And here's what I'm going to do, you know, from this moving forward. You know, one of the things that I like is that you're like, well, no, you haven't talked me out of this yet. If I talked you out of it, that's totally fine too. But you know, stubbornness is half of success, right? Just showing up every day and doing the hard work. Being stubborn is how people are successful, because that means they just do the work. And doing the work and showing up every day is what's required to build, you know, any business, including an e-commerce business.
Yeah. I'll say, I mean, I think part of what I hadn't really put into words that is unique about my effort, what I'm trying to do, is that a lot of the music-themed stuff I felt like is so lame for years. It's really boring and lame. And so I would like to offer people modern, you know, some things that are new and exciting. And there's, you know, you can go on to Amazon, you can do a search for piano stuff, and there's stuff that's more exciting than what you can see here. You know, there's like people crafting bottle openers out of piano keys and stuff like that. But as somebody who's passionate about the piano itself, I think that's part of what drives my interest, is having some exciting options for people that haven't been there before.
Yeah, so what I hear you saying is product. Your product isn't that exciting yet either, right? So one of the things you need to figure out is, you know, there's this whole question of, will this audience buy this at the price and profitability, which, will, you know, are always business dynamics to be thinking about. But, you know, the first thing is, what's different and unique about your product? So you picked your audience, you're going to be researching them, and in that research, you're going to be asking them what kind of products they want. If you want to create something unique and differentiated, use them to give you some of that feedback. Let them tell you what that is. And, you know, they won't, you know, there won't be this aha, holy grail moment where the skies open up and give you the answer. But there will be things you may not have thought of, or things that reinforce what you're already thinking. You may find out, for example, that the piano teacher is totally willing to spend $200 on the perfect piano thing for herself, but the mom's only willing to spend $20. So yeah. You know, these are the things you're going to be thinking about and learning about.
Yeah, that's great.
Excellent.
I love it.
Cool. So you have your homework.
You've been listening to the Shopify Solutions Podcast with Scott Austin. This podcast is brought to you by Jade Puma, a full-service agency focused on Shopify. If you like what you heard, please leave a review and subscribe on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. If you have a question or comment, please send an email to scott@jadepuma.com.